Hello, listeners. Today is another day of Behind the Wrinkles, where Graham Priest chats with some of our senior residents in the district about their life and what they were doing before they got to be seniors, what they're doing now, what their future is. And last time we spoke with Ed Isaac, who's lived in Kapiti for many years and incidentally is a neighbour of mine. Ed was an ex-naval man. And in our previous interview, Ed, we got to the stage where you'd taken a commission and you decided to take a rest from your physical education training, and you decided that the way that you were training people was proper, possibly not the best way to get the best out of your people. So you were tasked with introducing a new method of doing things, and it wasn't being universally well received. So what was the outcome?
Well, the outcome was I was told that under the present leadership, nothing was going to happen until that leadership moved on. And fortunately, in a structured organisation and a hierarchical organisation such as the military, people tend to move on about every 2 years to a different role, and that means even the admiral moves on after two, sometimes up to 3 or 4 years, but they move on. And so the people who I was working to believed in what I was trying to do, but they said we're not going to get any traction under the current leadership, so you better find something else to do for the next couple of years. And what they gave me to do was to work at the leadership training school for non-commissioned ranks. And in that role, what I had to do was basically put onto people what I didn't believe in. I had to follow a set script, curriculum and so on. And I had a bunch of people helping me. I was in charge of it. So I had a bunch of people helping me who only got to where they got to through these old systems, and that was what they believed in. They'd been promoted, therefore what they'd learnt and the way they were doing things was the way to do things. And try as I might...
It must have been a very difficult situation for you.
It was, but I tried to apply the, funnily enough, I tried to apply the principles of personnel development that I'd learned earlier. And I didn't tell you in the last edition of this that I'd spent a bit of time as an instructor at the Outward Bound School at Anakiwa. And that was a civilian-run school based on an English system of developing youth to test them and to let them realise that they had more to offer than they themselves realised. And it was all to do with developing the people. And so that's what I tried to introduce. But I was swimming into the current.
My observation of kids that we send away from our Rotary Club to Anakiwa, they came back very different people.
Yes, well, it's a voyage of self-discovery, and that people find within themselves things that they didn't expect to find, and they also find that other people around them have strengths and weaknesses too, and that everybody has their strengths and everybody has some weaknesses. And, you know, the team works better when these are understood and provided for.
So you had a pretty fair idea that your ideas actually worked. So how did you try and introduce it once you're back in full-time Navy?
Well, what I had to do was develop the entire project system. So I was given a project to do. I was given 2 years to do it, and it was impossible to to achieve that in 2 years. I didn't just fall back on my own resources. I did courses and I did a lot of reading, and I came up with a concept, which was to rejig the entire way we started with people. So right from the bottom, we needed people who were prepared to develop themselves, given the support and direction of their superiors. And then you had to teach the superiors how to give that support and direction as required for the person in the circumstance that they found them. And this was completely new, because prior to that, military thinking was simple. It was the leadership qualities of you know, the personal qualities of the leader that was the only thing that was important. People below the leader were just there to do what they were told to do by the leader, and certainly no thinking was allowed. You know, if you used your initiative, that was one way to get into trouble.
So this would pretty rapidly change the sort of person that you were looking to try and induct into the Navy.
I think it's translated down into that now, and we're now talking 25 years later. You know, the big ship takes a bit of a while to change course, but it is the model that I introduced is the model that is being used today within the Navy side of New Zealand Defence Force. Of course, it's the people who run the Navy are the operations branch, and they're the people who say Port 20, and they're not looking for somebody to say, I think it should only be Port 15, sir. Port 20 it is, and full ahead both, and damn the torpedoes. They weren't looking for any input from anybody else.
It takes almost a whole generation to change.
It does. It does. But you have to start somewhere. And we started by changing all of the promotion courses so that people were introduced to this new way of thinking. Of course, when they got, you know, it's one thing doing a course, but then you go back to the workplace where the people haven't done the course and you've got these ideas, and very, very soon you slip back into what you've been taught before, or the way you've been brought up. One of the things is, you know, one of the concepts I used to put across to people was that abused trainees become abusive instructors, just like abused children become abusive adults. And that sort of way of thinking and that particular analogy did strike a chord with a number of people, and they tried to improve their way of going about their business. But it does take a long time to change a culture.
It does indeed. I know my daughter's very large company that she works for introduced a whole new method of moving from a very hierarchical bureaucracy to a flat planning, totally different way of working. And some of the older hands just couldn't cope, and they up stakes and left. But what they've got left with is a much more efficient and not democratic, but people get listened to nowadays instead of being told what to do.
Yes, at the end of the day, the person with the rank or the person with the responsibility makes the decisions, but those decisions these days are made more collaboratively than hitherto. I'll tell you a little anecdote that happened in the Navy many years ago. I was on Lachlan, and we were coming into we were doing some surveying in the Cook Islands, and we had to come to anchor just outside a reef on the lee side of the weather on that day. And the order from the bridge came down, slip port anchor. And the petty officer in charge on the forecastle where the anchors are slipped from went back and said, "But sir, slip port anchor," was the response. So, "Aye, aye, sir." Slip the port anchor. It wasn't attached to its cable. And, you know, we had to put out a Dan boy and come back 3 months later to salvage the anchor. You know, the crew on the forecastle had prepared the starboard anchor. Everybody seemed to know this except the man on the bridge.
That's pretty analogous to the way a lot of companies operate.
Yeah.
Hmm. So it pays to listen at times to your men. So, okay, after you got this course up and running, what next?
Well, then I was put in charge of running the school that ran all of the promotion courses, but it was separate from the new entry school. And, you know, to make this thing work, the people that were the product of new entry training had to be ready to take this new type of leadership. They had to be people willing to contribute, willing to be listened to, and willing to take charge of their own careers and so on. And so, you know, I had to advocate for quite a long time to introduce the concepts into the new entry school, which prior to that had been nothing but a square bashing, break people down and try and build them up through discipline, enterprise. So I worked hard at that and eventually won through. But again, it was, I mean, this took years.
You'd have to be like a dog with a bone.
Well, you have to persevere, you have to be obstinate, and you have to be patient. And I was, and I rubbed up a few people the wrong way along the way, but I outlasted a lot of them. So, because every 2 years, whoever it was who didn't agree moved on, because that's how the system worked.
So longevity has got some value.
Well, the thing was that because I was the only one running this project, they kept me in the job, and so I did outlast a lot of incumbents.
Right, so the thing's running successfully. Why did you move away from it?
Well, the Navy started to move forward. They started to realise that their leadership not only depended on what the people down below were doing, but on the strategies and the way the whole business was being operated. And so the Admiral of the time took a lot of advice around the country and so on, and internationally, and signed the Navy up to the New Zealand Business Excellence Foundation. And he was looking for somebody to become, you know, his go-to man to talk to about this sort of thing. And I was selected to do that, and I became an examiner for the New Zealand Business Excellence Foundation and learnt a hell of a lot about how business is, you know, ideal business is run. And the framework is known internationally as the Baldrick method, and I became the Navy's sort of guru on that. And so the Navy tried to change the entire way of thinking by, you know, strategically and so on, customer focus and all that sort of thing. These things were, as you can imagine, a lot of senior people said, "Customers, Navy, we don't have customers," and so on. So there was a lot of talking to people and convincing them that in actual fact we do have customers and they do have expectations and it's our job to meet them and so on, rather than perhaps an analogy would be the medical profession, where doctors used to be the people who told everybody what happened with their health, rather than listen to them to find out what they wanted with their health. So that's what I did courses and all that sort of thing, and became an examiner. I examined units in the fleet and gave reports on that and so on.
Right. So that was going swimmingly. What happened after that?
Well, during that, actually, as it turned out, in around about 2000, before that, I came back from leave in 1996, and the prison officers in New Zealand were going on strike, and they needed somebody to take charge of the Navy contribution to manning the prisons. And, for my sins, I ended up in charge of Auckland Prison East, which is the maximum security prison, and lived in the prison for the period of the lockdown, which was 18 days. And then I'd done a fairly good job, reportedly. And so...
What was it like?
Oh, it was eye-opening for me. And it changed my view about prisons and so on, particularly that type of prison.
From what to what?
Well, I had a certain liberality of thought, believing that, some people could be turned around and made into good, productive citizens. But I can tell you that the people who are in maximum security prisons are not those sorts of people. I read their files, we categorised them as either sad, mad, or bad, and some of them were combinations of all three. I do believe that quite a number of people who are in maximum security should actually be in mental homes, or under mental care, psychiatric care.
Well, they should have been long before they got to that stage.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's an indictment on society, really, that people are allowed to get to that stage, but there are some that you can't do anything with apart from lock them up.
Yeah, there are some very sad cases, and, I don't want to go into the details of that, but I certainly... I can see how prison officers get pretty cynical about the people that they're in charge of.
Indeed. So you did a pretty fair job of being a prison officer. What next?
The next thing was I then became the person who did all the projects that nobody else wanted to do, or they couldn't find somebody whose career could be stalled by taking on a project that needed to be done. In 2001, the Australian Federation celebrated 100 years of federation in Australia. And New Zealand gifted to Australia a couple of arches at the beginning of their Anzac Avenue, which goes up to their war memorial in Canberra. This was an $80 million gift that New Zealand gave, and I was in charge of, the gift of the actual ceremony of giving it to the Australians. So these arches, which are somewhat reminiscent of the McDonald's arches, but they're in bronze, one either side of the avenue going up to the memorial, and the New Zealand government gifted it, and my job, as I was told by the Prime Minister's department was to make Helen Clark look good on the day. And so I was in charge of 150 people, Haka Party, a Royal Guard, and band, and so on. And there was a bit of Australiana included in it, and I had to talk with the local Aborigines to get them to participate as well. So it was New Zealand's show. I was in charge of it, and it really worked out well.
It's a bit ironic that the Prime Minister of the day, who was anti-royal, had a Royal Guard.
Well, it was a guard of 150 New Zealanders and 150 Australians. And at the time, the Australians had a full-time standing ceremonial guard. They had about 300 or 400 people in it, and they were all volunteers, and they were all selected because of their, you know, their the way they performed their drill and so on. I had 150 people who were conscripted, detailed off from the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, all of whom had different drill. So when an Army person turns to the right, it's a different way than the Air Force man turns to the right, and the Navy's different again. So we were different, and so I only had a fortnight to train these people. We trained them, and when we got over to Australia, we had to then get the Aussies to fall into line, and they wouldn't. And so,
is that unusual?
I had a day and a half. No, not unusual at all. I had a day and a half to have the New Zealand contingent learn the Australian drill, which was different again. So the funny thing was that on the day, the Australians were upstaged by the performance of the New Zealanders, and the warrant officer of the Australian Army sort of disciplined his performers afterwards because he was embarrassed by it. Anyway, we did that, and
you made Helen look good.
That was the main object of the exercise, I believe. You might know that the Australian Prime Minister of the time was a short bloke, and we had to have him standing on a step so that he could look Helen Clark in the eye. So had to deal with things like that.
They didn't actually have a very good relationship, I believe.
Well, I didn't get that close to it. You know, this was a matter above that type of thing. This was country to country rather than person to person.
Great. So that was successful. So what did they find for you to do next?
Well, they sent me back to the management training school where all these courses that I'd produced were being run. But it was running pretty well without too much input from me. People had changed, and they were self-empowered. They knew what they had to do, and they were making a good job of it. And so I looked around for other things to do, and I ended up going to East Timor because the person who was supposed to go unfortunately had a family issue that was very tragic, and at the last minute he couldn't go, and they asked me if I would go.
That would have been a pretty hairy place to have a posting.
It was. It was an unsettled place at the time. It was under military rule, and I wasn't, you know, the New Zealand and Australian contingents were in lockdown over there, and they are only allowed out to do peacekeeping patrols of the streets. Whereas my job was as an advisor to the Chief of Defence Force over there on how to set up their military. And I lived in the community. And so it was, you know, it was an eye-opener again. Very interesting thing. I wasn't able to speak the language of the local people very well. I knew how to count to 10 in the days of the week, hello, goodbye, and thank you. But and during my 8 months there, I did my best to improve that. But all the rules were written in Portuguese, which I had no Portuguese. And the lingua franca, the way to talk to anybody around was in Bahasa Indonesia. And I didn't have any of that either. And I didn't have an interpreter. And I'd had a 3-week course on how to deal with this situation. And so most of it was charades. But my job was to advise them on policy and things like that. And it was very difficult to come to grips with what needed advising on. And the Minister of Defence at the time, who I was reporting to, Phil Goff, he was very good, but he made it clear to me that there were competing interests over there, the Chinese, the Portuguese, the United States, Australia. They all had their agendas. And New Zealand's agenda was different from all of those. He told me clearly that my job was to help the East Timorese to do what the East Timorese wanted to do and to advise them on the best ways of doing it. And so it was a very interesting time.
Well, I would imagine the Australians would be very interested because of the gas and oil.
Absolutely. That was their primary interest over there. But they did a lot of good too. I don't want to run down the Australians too much. They had built schools and clinics and things all over the country. But unfortunately, whenever the natives got restless, they were the targets of their arson and so on. So, you know, the only asset the country really had was its youth, and to tear down the schools and so on didn't seem to be of much use at all.
Oh, same thing's happening again in the Solomons, isn't it?
It is. These people have got a long way to go. But they've also got a long way to go because they've got no resources. So it's not an ethnic thing. It's an opportunity thing. When they get an opportunity, they're just as good as anybody else.
So, did you have any really scary moments there?
I did, quite a number, but. I never came under rifle fire or that type of thing, but certainly I was attacked by gangs of youths with rocks and so on, which is bloody scary. One day I went to work, and you learned how to avoid trouble by looking, you know, as you were driving, you kept an eye out about 200 metres ahead so that if you needed to, you could do a U-turn. But on this particular day, I went to work only to find that when I was about, and it was about 10 kilometres away where I was working, when I'd got about 7 kilometres down the road, there was a roadblock and I had to do a U-turn. Well, after I'd done the U-turn, there was a roadblock stopping me from getting back. And there was a side road I knew about, and so I went down the side road. Well, to get down the side road, I'm driving at about 50 kilometres an hour, avoiding goats, chickens, dogs, pigs, and children all over the place, only to be stoned by a big gang of dissenters, and my vehicle was written off. I escaped. I got through it. Broken windows, rocks in the car, and and so on. But it was a scary moment.
I can imagine. Okay, well, I assume that you served out your time in Dili and you swallowed the anchor.
Yes, I came back from that a little bit disillusioned because the changes that I'd asked to or, you know, tried to bring about had basically been made. And there was no real role in that now for me. They trained up sharper minds than mine to be the admiral's go-to person on business excellence and things like that. And the promotion schools were doing very well without my input. And
so you'd work yourself out of a job,
basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And for that, at some stage, you got presented with an MBE.
I did, and that was for my that was for that work. It was for the work that I'd done, and it was for my contributions to leadership of the Royal New Zealand Navy. So it wasn't me leading the Royal New Zealand Navy. It was my contributions to the leadership ethos.
Great. Well, they don't exactly hand them out with a packet of cornflakes, so you must have deserved it, Ed. Run out of time again.
Yeah.
So you've had a very interesting career right through the path in the Navy, and you're very much enjoying retirement in Ryman's Village. This has been another session of Behind the Wrinkles with Graham Priest. Today's guest, Ed Isaacs, ex-naval man. Thank you for listening.
This program is made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.